You're listening to Mom and Doc Talk, where we talk all things healing pans and pandas with an emphasis on homeopathy.
Hi, I'm Jody the Mom.
And I'm Dr. Barr the Doc, and welcome to Mom and Doc Talk, where we are joined today to talk to someone who within the naturopathic and integrative doctor realm needs no introduction, who I think might need a little bit of an introduction to the PANS community, though once you guys hear what he has to say, he's not going to need any introduction at all anymore, because the ability for Dr. Paul Anderson to share really complex things and make them very simple and understandable and relatable is just, he's second to none. Let me just take a minute to introduce him to you guys really quickly, and then we'll go ahead and get started and talking about this really important topic for PANS and PANDAS families, which is biofilm. So Dr. Anderson is a recognized educator and clinician in integrative and naturopathic medicine with a focus on complex chronic illness and cancer. In addition to 3 decades clinical experience, he also was head of the interventional arm of the U.S. NIH-funded human research trial using IV and integrative therapies in cancer patients. He founded Advanced Medical Therapies in Seattle, Washington, a clinic focusing on cancer and chronic diseases, and now focuses his time in collaboration with clinics and hospitals in the U.S. and other countries. Former positions include multiple medical school posts, professor of pharmacology and clinical medicine at Bastyr University, and chief of IV services for Bastyr Oncology Research Center. He is co-author of the Hay House book, Outside the Box Cancer Therapies, with Dr. Mark Stengler, and the Lioncrest publishing book, Cancer, The Journey from Diagnosis to Empowerment. He is also co-author with Dr. Osborne and Dr. Carter of the IV textbook, A Scientific Reference for Intravenous Nutrient Therapy. Welcome, Dr. Anderson. I'm so happy to have you here. I can honestly say that part of my success in getting through naturopathic medical school is thanks to some of the training that you did for us to help people pass their boards, which is where I learned just how good you are at helping people to understand complex things and make it a simple, understandable thing. So I'm really excited to have you here to talk to us about biofilms today. So welcome.
Thanks for having me.
Well, let's just go ahead and dive right in. You've told us a little bit more about what you do through the bio, but tell us about the work that you put into really being able to understand all of these complex things. I mean, you didn't even give yourself credit here. You are the trainer of the doctors, right? Like you are the resource for so many natural and integrative doctors that, you know, you've got your own conferences even that you put together, a lot of them on neuroimmune conditions too, to really help people understand this. So tell us more about what you do and how you're able to take all of these really complex things and to synthesize it so that people can really do something with it.
well, thank you. So number one, I've been doing this a long time. Mm-hmm. So that probably helps. I have always throughout my career attracted extremely difficult patients, both in the cancer and the chronic illness community. Mm-hmm. So really even in the very beginning, but after the first year, I only had, pretty advanced types of things. And when it comes to PANS and PANDAS, we were treating that before it had a name, mm-hmm. very well recognized pattern. Same with SIBO and all the POTS and all the other cool things we do nowadays that have names. Mm-hmm. And I think the other side of it is the explaining part is more. So I've been teaching in the naturopathic and integrative community this is my 30th anniversary of teaching. Mm-hmm. 10 years prior to that, I was teaching in other parts of the medical community. So 40 years of teaching, either you just really hate your students or you actually like teaching, one or the other. and I think there's just repetition of trying to find ways to explain things. Is something you have to practice. And now I've been doing it close to a half century, I guess that helps.
I will say that there's a very good chance that anybody who's listening to this, who has seen any sort of integrative healthcare provider, naturopathic doctor, for anything related to PANS, that they have most certainly learned something from this man, from Dr. Paul Anderson. So again, we're really glad to be able to come right to the source, for our questions today.
All right.
Or let's start at the very basics. Tell us what a biofilm is.
It's a great place to start. So Biofilms are not just in humans and other mammals. They're all over our world, probably in other worlds too, but we know about them here. They were first really looked at in oceanography and dentistry. Those are the two places that they've been really well described. So they're in wet places. You can think of it that way. In oceanography, biofilms are just a way that you think of how massive the ocean is, and then you might have microbial communities, et cetera. They're going to get lost and not be able to do their community thing if they don't have a place to stay. Well, if you go to humans, so, and this could be any mammal, really. The reason we discovered them in the mouth first is it's easy to get to, and people started doing microscopy of what is it that are in dental caries, or what is it in, you know, things that might be leading to the decay of teeth, et cetera. And so then they started to see, okay, so there's this film, and it really resembles this thing from oceanography. When I point this way, the ocean is that way from my house. So just so you know, my studio, I've got the ocean here. So anyway, oceanography, hey, it turned out to be kind of the same thing. Now, the important part, I think, is we want to keep in mind, much like we have trillions of bacteria and even viruses and other things in our body that are kind of normal flora, we also have normal biofilms. So when I'm teaching people about biofilms, the first hurdle to get over, because it cuts both ways if you don't get over the hurdle, is it's a spectrum. And so on, say, the left end of the spectrum, you have normal biofilms that are just part of being a human. They are all over the place. Now, obviously, there's a spectrum, then there's more other places. So if we go to the right of the spectrum, we have sort of early and late biofilms. And probably myself and maybe a couple other people writing about it have coined phase one and phase two in the pathological biofilm world. So just like we don't want to wipe out all our good flora in our gut or anywhere else in our body, we also don't want to, you know, biofilms aren't all bad. Like just the presence of a biofilm is just being human. But the longer a person is sick, or if you take a child who has PANS or any other early inflammatory disorder, which unfortunately is getting more common, you know, in the last 10, 15 years with children, you accelerate the growth of biofilms into these pathological or not what you want sorts of layers. And then they actually take on a life of their own at that point, and they become part of chronic inflammatory disorders. They become part of the reason people do not heal and get better. They become part of drug resistance and herbal resistance and all kind of other resistance. So they're really, once they're pathological, they're not helping you at all.
Yeah. What about what is actually in a biofilm?
So biofilms have a, you can think of it like a scaffolding structure. And this is something to a degree that is a that helps you figure out the difference if you're doing research, let's say, between normal biofilms and then early or phase one pathological biofilms and late phase two. So what I will tell patients is that the early ones, like the normal kind, are just like little pup tents, and they have this little bit of scaffolding that sort of certain bacteria mostly will create the scaffolding, and then bacteria and many other things will get in there and they just hang out. But it's like pup tents. Phase one pathological ones are more like a stick built house. So if you've seen the pup tent and seen a regular house, it's sort of like there's more going on there. So the scaffolding then starts to take on minerals and other amino strings and proteins and other stuff like that. And it gets bigger and bigger. And then when you get over to phase two biofilms, if you've either been sick a long time, or in the case of our topic today, you have a child with a very aggressive inflammatory condition, they're like skyscrapers. So it's obviously, if you're thinking of, you know, looking at them from the front, but also how much trouble am I going to have dealing with something that's a pup tent size versus a stick-built house size versus a skyscraper? it's really, you're talking about different things and different ways of treating as you go along. So it's really important that, you know, we keep that in mind. But basically, the normal, quote unquote, biofilms that we all have, even more super healthy, are small amounts of peptides and other things that are produced largely by some bacteria. There's other things that produce biofilms, but that are kind of just there. They're small number of bacteria that we might consider commensal in small amounts. And they make the biofilms, then other things might come in and hang out. So it'd be kind of like if you have a pup tent, let's say, and this is your normal biofilms, and you have, you're sitting in there and you get a rainstorm, other people or creatures may come in. That's exactly what happens with biofilms. They become a hive. So then if you think about the pathologic ones, stick-built house, you could get so many people in there, different types, maybe animals. A skyscraper, you're going to have a lot of different ones. So if you think of the hive of pathologic nature, the bigger it gets, the more complex it gets. And everybody, unlike a house, really, hopefully, everybody inside of a biofilm, whether they're a parasite, a virus, a fungus, a bacteria, any other creature, they then start sharing genetic material. So they're not even the same bugs that you knew in the beginning.
Mm. Fun. So what takes a normal biofilm, like a, you know, like that exists in all healthy people, right? Like I'm, I've got contacts in right now. So I've got a biofilm forming with my contacts in, right? Sure. So what takes something from being a normal biofilm or like a healthy biofilm to become pathogenic?
So the most core answer really is anything that longer than an acute illness disrupts the normal homeostasis in our body. So we normally have this balance, right? And you can think of it, because more people probably have heard the concept of, you know, good flora in the GI tract. Mm-hmm. Well, if we take antibiotics, we might disrupt that. Or if we're really sick for a while, we might disrupt the good flora. It's kind of the same with biofilms, because they're related to good and bad flora. But if we don't have a typical acute illness that kind of rises through a fever and you get better and then you're all done and all good, acute illnesses don't probably shift your biofilms, but chronic inflammatory conditions shift not only the flora in your GI tract, but also can trigger some of the bacteria that make a lot of the scaffolding to grow, produce more, and then attract more other unfortunate, you know, viruses and parasites and things into it. So a lot of it is the longer we are inflamed. So we use inflammation as a euphemism for our immune system is just out of balance, right? Mm-hmm. Well, if you take a child or young adult with PANS, their system hasn't had the signals to stop auto-inflaming. Well, that's not just in the nervous system, that's also in the gut as well. And there's this huge crosstalk, especially in neuroinflammatory problems, there's a huge crosstalk between the brain's ecology and the gut's ecology, or the lack thereof. So the longer we have neuroinflammation, actually we build more biofilms too. So it's systemic inflammation, neuroinflammation, and then that leads to changes in flora that's good and bad. The excessive building of more biofilm scaffolding, and then the attraction of other, you know, inappropriate viruses, bacteria, etc.
So it sounds like in PANS cases, that the biofilms themselves are not necessarily a problem to start with, but it's because of the inflammatory process that's happening already with PANS that biofilms become more of a problem. Is that accurate?
In most cases, yes. Okay. And just for, you know, comparison, a lot of adults, let's say, that wind up with either a neuroinflammatory process or some other chronic illness may have already been working on pathological biofilms, but they're older, they've had more time and more dysfunction. And so for them, the trouble may be more in the beginning with the biofilm. With a child, in most cases, although I have a couple of personal cases where we talk about traumas to the biome at birth. Mm-hmm. So that kind of goes back to the beginning. In most cases with children, it's more part and parcel of the inflammatory process. Then these things build up and they make it hard to treat the inflammatory process. So it's more like a chicken and egg thing with kids.
Do you ever find that kids with PANS in particular, or anybody, you know, who has complex chronic illness and has like a misdirected immune response, if you will, do you ever find that they can be reactive to even normal biofilms, or is it only pathogenic biofilms that they're going to be reactive to?
There's not as much research on that. So what I'm about to say would be more just clinical experience. Mm-hmm. I think that although in younger people, the building of pathogenic biofilms can occur more quickly than in older people. Mm-hmm. Technically speaking, the normal biofilms that are in the background should not have much of a role in the pathology. Okay. But if you consider that what allows the normal biofilm to morph into a phase one or two pathological one is inflammation and disruption of, you know, the ecology, that's a fairly quick trip for a child. Yeah.
Yeah. And I'm sure Jody will want to ask you a question about this too, but like, I guess where I'm trying to get to is, we see it so much with kids with PANS who have, like a loose tooth, and like the impacts that you can have of disruptions to the biofilm and like the loose teeth causing a flare. It's like so pervasive that it's like almost everybody. So is it safe to say that if they're having a flare from a loose tooth, that they likely have pathogenic biofilms, or could it even be that the fact that their immune system is so heightened and so misdirected that any loosening of a biofilm from a loose tooth could contribute to a flare, even if it's not necessarily a pathogenic biofilm? That's what I guess what I'm trying to get to.
Right. Well, yeah, I think there's two parts to that answer. One part is biofilms are not the same all the way through the digestive tract, if we even limit it to that. So the mouth may actually have more advanced ones earlier, right? Because it's just so easy to build them in there. And we have the gum pockets and everything. So that's one piece of the puzzle there. The other piece is exactly what you said, and that is that once the sensitivity and the autoinflammation is going, it doesn't take much to poke the bear and, you know, kind of let the genie out of the box. And it's just things with teeth, tonsils, adenoids, anything in this area is just such a huge trigger, and a big part of that's biofilms. The other part is there's a lot of, you know, normal resident bacteria, or maybe a bit pathogenic bacteria that are normal here, that are very unfriendly once the immune system sees them. So that is a real big thing. And later we'll talk about reactions and unwinding and everything. And one of the concepts clinically that, you know, I'm trying to get across to doctors, because they'll miss it till they see it, is if everything is calm, your child in this case may not be having a ton of symptoms, but they're not getting better. So then you go in and you disrupt things in order to get the ball rolling. And if you're not ready to support that body through the disruption, the immune system is just spinning, you know, and it has this huge overreaction, which is normal in a sense, but also you don't want to leave somebody there either. So it's a bit of both, but teeth, tonsils, you know, pharynx, I've seen so many things there just be triggers, because the biofilms grow faster there, and oddball bugs, especially bacteria, hang out in the mouth.
Are there any specific infections that are associated with biofilms?
Well, there are, but I'm trying to answer in the way that makes the most sense. if you look and you get real reductionistic, which is what I don't want people to do, but let's just for a moment say you're working in a petri dish. If you take something like Pseudomonas, which is in small amounts found everywhere in the human body, it's a super bug. It's very hard to kill. But normally, if your immune system works well, it's marginalized. So it just sits there. And often they will build the pup tent biofilms and hang out, right? And they can't do anything because the immune system sees them. So things like Pseudomonas are good biofilm builders. Actually, if you, with the magic of the internet, if you put something even into Google and say bacteria forming biofilms, you'll get a list of the top, 10 or 100. And it's things that we always see come up as people get more and more dysfunctional GI flora, more chronic infections, all that. And those are already in our body. All of the biofilm makers are, there's other ones too you've heard of. So yes, there is an infectious component, but it's more the disruption that allows these low-level normal pathogens that are normal flora in small amounts that allows them to sort of grow wildly. And then they just do their thing. They just start making biofilms. Well, then all the other abnormal actors jump in, and then they start to create, like I said, their own new microbe, which could be polymicrobial. So it's really more, if you want to step back away from the petri dish, it's more the disruption that allows those guys to come through.
I remember seeing or hearing a report of a finding that the bacteria in hospitals were doing exactly basically what you just described, that they're sharing their genetic material and that they were conveying drug resistance to each other without ever having been exposed to the drug. So, I mean, that's just happening in our bodies right now when we have this pathogenic biofilms. So with that being said, like recognizing that like biofilms are normal and then they get to these different levels, like when do they become a problem or do they themselves cause a problem?
Well, they can on their own cause a problem. But usually what we see is because it's, I mean, there are certain tests you can look at biofilms and, in research, it's a little easier, but clinically speaking, there's not a lot of terribly useful tests for it. So without that sort of information, we surmise that they are there, and then they get worse when the inflammation or the chronic illness goes on. What we don't know is, are they already building up and then they allow PANS or some other, chronic illness? Or does the neuroinflammatory process start that ruins the ecology of the GI tract and then it's, you're off to the races there? Probably both happen. And so people will, ask, and it's usually in adults. And so there's two children, there's a different answer. People say, well, how do you know someone has, well, everyone has biofilms. How do you know if they're pathogenic? If you've been chronically ill more than months, you at least have sort of the phase one low level ones. If you are chronically ill for years, you have the skyscraper ones. There's no debating that in all of the biofilm research in the world. In children, as I said, there's often a quicker trip. And so they'll go from the pup tents to the steakhouses to the, to the skyscrapers quite quickly.
And why is that?
Well, part of it is their floral ecology is much, it's like their immune system, it's much more responsive than
it's just growing and changing rapidly,
faster. Also, and I think there's a little bit of research on this as far as and I don't mean there's good research on this for other problems, but as far as biofilms go, my suspicion, because some of the more tricky cases with children I've had are when and I forget there's a primary paper and a bunch of others where they actually came up with a score where if the baby was born and you have the scoring system for how messed up their biome is going to be, right? So C-section, you get so many points, antibiotics, you get so many points, all of this, right? Well, some of the earliest cases with the most neurological inflammation I've ever seen, they had one of everything, you know? And so my suspicion is there's a birth component as well. In some kids, it's not there. So obviously they can develop it on their own. And in some children, it like what you might see at 7 to 10 years old, you see at 2 years old, you know? So there's a bit of chicken and the egg thing, but once a person is that ill, it's somewhere in the pathogenic structure and you get resistance factors like you just brought up where, you know, usually you think of bacteria sharing DNA with each other, but viruses can take bacterial DNA and alter it and put it back. Parasites, everybody can do it, right? So it's not a wonder that they're as complicated as they are.
I think this is one reason too. I mean, as you know, we're not going to focus a whole lot on homeopathy today because that's not your area of expertise, but homeopathy is our area of expertise. And that's one reason that I think we see so many kids when they fail to respond to other typical things are responding well to homeopathy, because homeopathy is not necessarily focusing on trying to kill a specific thing. It's trying to help your immune system and help your body fight things off on its own. So we're not having to rely on like any of this like cross sharing of genetic material, making things more challenging, and the lack of tests that we have for things too.
It's an incredibly clinically driven process, which is okay, but it'd be nice if we had more objective info.
It makes it challenging, that's for sure.
What things might a PANS parent see in a child that is having problems with biofilms?
Well, if they're already in some form of treatment, one huge tell, if you will, is that either they fail antimicrobial therapies or they develop resistance very, very quickly. Those are hallmarks of biofilm activity. The other thing that we see, which sort of is the same, is you're treating, you think, right? You're treating these two bugs, right? And then on the next test, the child is as sick or sicker, and those two bugs seem less, but there's two other ones, right? So everybody just trades places. So it's the perpetual cycle of, I got to kill these two guys, but I don't realize there's four more waiting to take its place, you know? And so it's that sort of revolving door of resistance and treatment resistance. And, you know, what I tell parents and adults a lot is you need to remember that it is microbes in the human body. For every one we can test and find out maybe it's there or not, there's probably 20 pathogens right behind it that we can't test for. So you have to think of it as an ecologic problem. And, you know, to your point with using homeopathy where it's aimed at trying to get the system engaged again, the one wonderful thing, although it can create a lot of side effects, the wonderful thing about child system is if you re-engage a child system, it has a lot more fight than adult system does in it, you know, which can be very, very helpful.
So the biofilms themselves, it sounds like the presence of a pathogenic biofilm can cause a problem, whether it's been like actively disrupted or not. But then from what I understand, like, so the presence of a pathogenic biofilm can cause problems and feeling like where it's just, you're not getting better. But then from my understanding, when we have a disruption to the biofilm, like we do with like loose teeth and dental procedures, that's when we get a big spike in flares. So what do you see really tends to disrupt biofilms other than like, you know, loose teeth and surgeries and dental procedures, and what happens once they're disrupted?
Yeah. So it depends a little bit on how long they've been there. So if you look at, and this is where some of the concepts of phase 1 and phase 2 pathogenic biofilms come from, if you look at a lot of research, kind of in the standard infectious disease research around biofilms, they will talk about how, and this would be like phase one pathogenic biofilms, antibiotics can disrupt them. Mm-hmm. Every aromatic herb you've ever heard of can disrupt them. Other incidental things that might be part of a diet or something like that, you know, can disrupt them. And a number of other things, like a big shift in the microbiome, potentially, right? So in the phase one area, you could have this unplanned disruption because you gave the child antibiotics that they needed, but you didn't realize part and parcel of that is here's the biofilm opening up. Or you give them, you know, a mixed herbal product, and it turns out, you know, half the herbs in there are good biofilm disruptors, right? Mm-hmm. So that's one time we see flare-ups. And what I have seen, and I will just limit this to PANS, you know, the pediatric patients, because mm-hmm. adults get a bit more complex. A disruption to the biofilm, regardless of how bad the biofilm is it's an incredible immunologic cytokine disturbance. And so, and I use this analogy, which works for me because I like old movies. My apologies, you have to look it up if you don't know Casablanca. But it's a fairly famous movie. So there's a scene in there, you know, where the prefect of police is obviously aware of what goes on at Rick's, and they have gambling in the back. No spoilers here. So, but then the Germans come to town, and it's World War II. So he has this line, the prefect of police, where he stands up and he says, "Rick, I'm shocked. There's gambling going on in this establishment." And then someone walks up and hands him his winnings, and he's doing it all for a show. So the point of that story is, it's your immune system goes from no recognition of all of this stuff that it should be fighting with, but it doesn't know it's there, to mm-hmm. suddenly, oh my God, look at all of these problems. So your mm-hmm. poor immune system, and in a child, you get this flash-like reaction, biofilm starts to open up. And it's like we went from not knowing anything was wrong to lots of things that we haven't seen or we didn't know we were seeing. The immune system goes into overdrive, right? And the more pathologic, the longer biofilm's been there, the more aggressive that response is, okay? So the reaction, if it's on the lower end, let's say you know, because I've seen this happen, not quite sure what's going on, and you have some maybe herbal things that the child can get in their food or get him somehow. And then all of the sudden they start having nightmares, or they stop sleeping, or, you know, some big inflammatory rise. That's a hallmark of the biofilm's opening, not because of the biofilm, but because the immune system suddenly says, oh, look at all this we have to take care of. And it starts mm-hmm. making the thousands of chemicals the immune system used to crosstalk. And those, unfortunately, also go and create the neuroinflammatory response that we'd like to keep a lid on. Yeah. So it's like, this would be great in the gut or wherever the biofilm is. I don't want that in my brain, but I can't separate. Right.
Because by the time we can't put up walls to block it.
You can't say, I'd just like the biofilm disruption here. And I'd love the immune system to be active, but could it leave the brain alone? And there's no way to, you know, tease those two apart. So the worse the biofilm is, though, and again, this is more clinical retrospectively looking, but I've seen it lots, the worse the neurological response is, right?
Yeah.
Dr. Anderson, I've heard parents talk about biofilm busters. What are they and why do you use them?
Yeah. So big picture, a biofilm buster or breaker is anything that would disrupt this structure, this lattice kind of structure. And so if you think about it, it's easier if you have a stick built phase one house there. You don't need as big of equipment to maybe open the door or break the windows out or whatever, you know, that you need to do. So a lot of them, a lot of the kind of commercially available things that you see in the supplement world would often include an aromatic herb or two, maybe another anti-infective sort of substance. Then you see things like chelators, okay, because there does become a metal or metalloid crystal matrix, which is part of it. So they might give a oral, you know, EDTA or something like that and go in, and that would help to separate the biofilm. So it depends on how elaborate the supplement is, but it could either be just aromatic herbs mixed together or some herbs and some EDTA and some other stuff like that. But that's what a biofilm breaker or buster is. That's not a problem. The limitation of those things is clinically, if you're using an agent or a group of agents that work on lower grade structures and you've got high grade structures, they kind of bounce off of them. So they'll get the weak biofilms, but they won't, you know, get the worse ones. So there's actually a dividing line between biofilm interrupters or biofilm busters that are for phase one and versus phase two types of biofilm. So a lot of the over-the-counter things, you know, they don't do a bad job with those earlier things. But what you have to keep in mind is if you're also treating with antimicrobials, they have their own biofilm breaking things, whether they're drugs or from the natural world, it doesn't matter. So you have to be careful about like how fast and how much biofilm breaking you do. And then if you get a more aggressive case, the phase two ones are, it's sort of like they actually have to be able to not just disrupt a little bit. They have to sort of make a wedge and then open the concrete up and disrupt it. You know, it's mm-hmm. a little tougher job to do.
Yeah.
And there's some of those that are over the counter and some are by prescription.
Yeah. So it's like the difference between needing like a hammer versus needing a jackhammer or like a
bulldozer.
Bulldozer.
Yeah. Like throwing a rock through the window in the house or bulldozing into, you know, a big building.
Right.
Yeah.
I'm curious if you've seen the use of biofilm busters cause flares in kids just because of the way that we're releasing lots more things to the.
If it could be true mathematically, 1,000%. Yeah.
Yeah.
And this is one of the things that, especially in children, I mean, I've seen bad experiences with adults, but with children, it happens much more quickly. And mm-hmm. the neurological disruption can be very, very aggressive. Okay. I've had, you know, PANS turned out, you know, to get diagnosed with PANS a little bit older, say teenagers probably had it for a while. Right. And the biofilm disruption, you know, goes too quickly without enough support on the other side. And had them go from just very disturbed and maybe some sleep disturbance to suicidal, you know. So I'm always really cautious when I talk to parents. It's like, you don't scare parents, but it's like, look, if this works and if we really start moving things around, we need this communication with you and the child and, you know, depending on their age and what's appropriate. But if they start feeling, especially neuroemotional things shifting, because they obviously don't feel great to start with, but if it shifts in any direction, great, it means we're opening things up. But also we have to do a lot of supportive things that, so the body's natural methods of balancing the immune overresponse come up to meet it, right? And especially when you get, you know, a child past 10 and they've been sick a while, all of the body's natural counter responses are so beat down that it's like you get a big immune response and it's like the body can't quite, you know, kind of come up there. And so the idea is it's not a bad thing we did that, but we want to balance it like right away if that's what happens. So it's just one of those clinical monitoring things. And it's also why I get a little nervous at times when I hear, you know, a parent might be just going to dive in and do a bunch of biofilm stuff with a child without somebody with eyes on it, you know, who knows. Yeah. Oh gosh, that's great, but we need this help over here. Yeah.
Right.
Yeah. What about, can you treat biofilms so that pathogenic ones go back to being normal?
Excellent question. And so just like the beginning where I was talking about the pup tents and the house phase one and the skyscraper phase two, the goal of treatment, whether you've got phase twos or phase ones, is to rewind back to just the pup tents. So the goal is not to treat biofilms forever, like especially in children, there should be a time limit. Now, just for reference, in adults, I've had that time be a couple of years, like because they've taken decades to mess up the system. In children, usually, even if they have big bad ones, like say the teenage and older group, it's aggressive and it's kind of, you know, a lot going on, but it's, you know, months, and then you're sort of backing off to phase one agents, and that might be months, and then you're sort of backing off to just let's reestablish the GI flora and let's reestablish the blood-brain barrier and the gut barriers, get them healed up, and then you go backwards. So just like you go from the left to the right to badness, treatment should take you from the right-hand side back to the left to normal, or as normal as you can get it.
Is there anything that we can do to prevent biofilms from becoming pathogenic in the first place?
I love that question. Because people will ask, like, well, why are biofilms such a big problem? So you should know that, like, so this is not just me, you know, making all this up. Prior to COVID, the CDC had biofilms as like one of its top three public health crises, okay, for about 10 years. And this is something that got no press at all. And it's because there's a number of factors that are unfortunate truths for the medical community. And I, through my work with biofilms, and I wound up developing some drug stuff I put in the public domain and almost got sued over that. But I've never made a dime off for any of the drugs that I designed, which was probably a bad move. But there were drug companies that were also doing this work, but they're working at a much higher level. So whatever. Mm-hmm. So they decided not to sue me. But what I learned during that process was, and this was largely when I was contacted by people in the drug development world, because I had started and I had put together all of these disparate papers that the government had kind of sequestered, because the government, for military purposes, biofilms are a huge problem. Think about dirty war wounds and everything, right? But also just there's a lot of reasons the military was doing things. So what I saw was that there is all this research, but it's really hard to find. And it's because lots of stuff the government made a little tough to get. And so the first thing in my discussions then with what I call the real biofilm researchers who develop drugs is they said, the government has identified this as like one of the biggest public health threats, and they don't want to tell anybody. Everybody leaves the hospital with a pathogenic biofilm, but we don't want to tell them that. So what we're working on is just developing biofilm preventive measures that become part of your surgical procedures and part of everything else. So we send fewer people home from the hospital with biofilms. Mm-hmm. One of the problems is that we send many babies home and they're not considered part of that food chain. They think of trauma, surgery, and spoke procedures and whatever. Babies, it's like they know the data, but they don't think of protecting, you know, the baby. So baby's kind of a problem there. So you got this huge triggering of biofilms from modern medicine, basically. You have a lot of other biofilm stuff, and there's you know, all of this research that shows what used to knock out biofilms doesn't work anymore. But what they're talking about is these phase two ones. So we have to develop these other agents, and that's where I came in. All that to say that, that there's a huge body of research that, again, no one really talks about anywhere that I've seen, that shows that there is an ease of disruption of biofilms at one level and not at another level. So then the logical question, so then I started to teach about this about 10 years ago. The big question was, well, humans have been here for however long, right? We've always had biofilms. Why didn't we develop them before? And, you know, the honest ones would say, we get modern surgery and, okay, great, great. But what about everybody else? Why are biofilms worse than they've ever been? Well, one of the things, if you look back sort of anthropologically at human development, we have a very short window of modern life, like 80 to 100 years, right? Mm-hmm. If you go back prior to that, and especially prior to 200 years ago, and I've done this, so you don't have to. everywhere I've looked in the whole globe, mm-hmm. if you look at traditional diets, every traditional diet has botanical additions either for preserving or for flavoring or a little of both. Mm-hmm. They're all different, but it doesn't matter whether you're in any part of Asia or Northern Europe or North America or South America or mm-hmm. anywhere. The indigenous diet that everybody was eating up until, let's say, 100 years ago in most places had botanicals in the diet every single day of one kind or another. And guess mm-hmm. what? 90% are biofilm disruptors.
Of course.
So if I'm eating biofilm disruptors as part of my diet every day, and also I'm not eating food that's been irradiated and killed and, you know, all of that stuff, mm-hmm. I am very unlikely to ever develop a biofilm that's pathogenic. And so if you look at biofilms being as pathogenic as they are now, it's largely a factor of modern technology and also modern inappropriate dietary, activity. Mm-hmm. The only good news is we can still incorporate all of those botanicals into our life and our diets. It's just that, especially westernized areas or, advanced technologic societies have gotten rid of a lot of them.
Mm-hmm. And the thing that's going to be challenging for a lot of people, I'm sure, who are hearing this is that, like, we don't even have connections to those original diets anymore, right? Like, we've lost our ability to do things the way it was done 100 years ago, because everything is in a package now.
And if those aren't part of your world, or your cooking or whatever, your tastes change too, So
yeah,
it's, whereas, even like I'm in mostly Northern Europe, you already tell by the lightness of my skin, Northern European. if I go back to the types of spices and things that were used in where my people came from, there was a lot of those still incorporated in our diets when I was young, 60 years ago. Mm-hmm. And over time, like, I'm probably the last generation where those sort of traditional things were part of it. I have friends, who are from, say, India or Pakistan, and they're still very largely, that's a big part of, the way they eat. So the other cool thing is, let's say you don't like your, whatever your native thing was, you could mm-hmm. take up an Asian,
adopt somebody else,
Middle Eastern, take up somebody's spice group, and it's going to largely be anti-biofilm. Yeah. Yeah. So that it's
variety in your diet.
Variety is always good, right?
All right. One more question before we get into the parent type of questions, the last couple of parent questions that I know Jody's got for us. How does mold contribute to issues with biofilms?
Yeah. Another modern world problem. So, Well, there's probably a couple of layers to that question, but the simplest way to say it is there are certain fungal things that, again, are at very tiny levels inside of our respiratory and GI tract, especially. Mm-hmm. And they normally kind of like Pseudomonas as a bacteria. They just hang out. They're very small. When we get sick, and in a, say, a child with this inflammatory stuff, sometimes the endogenous molds, fungus, will start to grow. Okay, so that's one thing. So you're sort of autotoxified. That also happens a lot in the upper respiratory system and the mouth. It's why people will do like a nasal spray that's a biofilm disruptor and their whole body melts down. It's because it's kind of like the loose tooth thing. You really poke the dragon and didn't realize how bad the problem was, right? So that's one thing. But mold in your environment, so if you're exposed to mold in the walls or whatever, that creates mycotoxins, which are a biotoxin, but for mold we call it mycotoxin. And the biggest mechanism why they trigger problems is that mycotoxins, among all the other bad things they do, are immune suppressive. So if you take and you look at, okay, what does it take to create a biofilm or let more bad creatures in a biofilm? The biggest thing keeping you from that, aside from maybe, you know, spices and herbs in your diet, is your immune system in your gut saying, no, we don't need any more of you, right? Mm-hmm. If I have chronic mold exposure and I have immune suppression from it, that's mm-hmm. also in my gut. And so then I can just kind of keep building, right? And by the way, and mold is probably, it's a huge topic right now, but we also need to keep in mind in modern medicine, there are a lot of drugs, especially given to adults, but more and more to children, that are also minor immune or major immune suppressants as well. Mm-hmm. And they're used in, you know, childhood autoimmunity and other stuff like that, but especially with adults. And they'll have the same problem, and they're often asymptomatic because the immune system is kind of, you know, unplugged there. Mm-hmm. But then the pathogenicity of the biofilm growing kind of is unchecked. And mm-hmm. and so mycotoxins do that, but there's a lot of drugs that do it too.
Yeah. No, it's interesting. There's a couple of docs in the PANS PANDAS community that they pretty quickly go to immune suppressants, like complete immune suppression. And it's sad to see that, like, you know, this is, you know, contributing to this for all these kids, where it just allows things to continue to build and build, and you don't get to see the problems and things just explode when it stops working completely.
Yeah. It's always, I mean, if you have, you know, a child that's really gone far into a flare and there's danger or something, sometimes for a short time, you know, you have to suppress it for safety, but long-term use, it's like, that should always be like the last thing you would ever do, because it's just going to perpetuate the other trouble. Yeah.
It's interesting. We actually just recorded a podcast about suppression too. So it's like, I think it's two episodes before this one. I'll put a link to it in the show notes, but how it relates to homeopathy and suppression, but it's not just homeopathy, like suppression can cause challenges no matter what form of medicine you decide to use.
So I feel like I'm hearing the voices of the mini PANS moms that will be listening to this episode going, talk about the teeth more, because that's the one thing that we are also interested in, because it is such a difficult thing with our kiddos, and it is almost every single tooth that gets loose. So is there anything that we can do to address biofilm specifically in the mouth?
Yeah. And I mean, one of the issues, of course, is not only with younger children, you're getting teeth that are falling out because they're getting their adult teeth and all, you know, so there's a whole different dynamic there. And they build biofilms faster than us adults do usually. And oral hygiene with little kids is always, you know, it's always tougher, you know, just to do. In the case, and I would say teeth definitely, but also keep in mind that the same thing may be happening in the tonsils and adenoids, or even in the sinuses, depending on the child. But teeth, because they fall out, that's another big problem. In addition to whatever you can do for regular oral hygiene, we use a lot of the liquid like biocidin with kids, and if we can teach them, you know, how to rinse and spit it out and all of that stuff, it's kind of preliminary, but it's kind of remarkable as well. I know some of the doctors have done some research looking at actual, you know, swabs and stuff from the gum pockets before and after, like biocidin or something like that. And it's amazing, like spirochete levels dropping and all sorts of other bad guys that often live in the mouth going down. So things like that, I'm sure there's other names of other products and things that can be done there. There are some, for example, like there's a lot of children's products that have xylitol. Xylitol is sort of a good phase one disruptor of biofilms. It probably tastes better than most of the other things that are used. And I've seen some rinses made with that, you know, where you kind of train the child to do that. Or, you know, if you have some game where there's a swab or something involved and you're kind of painting it on. You know, a lot of the other things that a person might do aren't really, like, until the child's older and can kind of understand the mechanics of not swallowing things and stuff, aren't really appropriate for little kids. So I tend to try stuff that if they swallow it, it's really not going to hurt anything, like xylitol-based stuff and biocidins liquids stuff and, you know, that kind of thing. You also, although most of them don't taste like the child would want to hold it in their mouth, most of the aromatic herbs, if you did dental, just swishes, you know, with that, as even as a dilute, can be done. So I mean, there's other things, but with teeth, it's a constant battle, really. Yeah,
it is. Are there certain dental procedures that are more likely to disrupt biofilms, thus causing more issues or possibly flares? And can flossing cause a disruption in biofilms?
Yeah, I think because most dental procedures I can imagine, I'm not a dentist, but I've worked a lot with dentists, disrupt the gum pockets and all the places where the biofilms are. So they often will flare no matter what they're doing in there, right? It is worse, and I just kind of have this haunting image of a child. It's okay, he's alive and everything, but a child I saw yesterday, and they just have, like, they're just a little young to do much without a fight and all that with the teeth, and he's just got so much stuff going on. So when he sees the dentist, it's a huge trauma, both, you know, both dental and immunologic. Once you get a child, if you can, to do regular hygienic things and then their own flossing, or you help them or whatever, if you can keep it, you know, clean, then you're actually in a better place. But the trip from lots of disruption and then boom, you know, your hands going out the window, to keeping it clean is a pretty big trip. And realistically, that's usually when the child's a bit older and they can tie into the, this is part of you feeling better, you know, and and they'll do it. I mean, I've seen some young kids do it, but yeah.
Well, Dr. Anderson, you've given us a whole lot of really good information. If I can, like, try and boil it down to make sure that, like, we're getting, like, as simple as possible, which is what I'm good at, is making hard things that somebody else has made simple for me even simpler. So we all have biofilms. They're not all pathologic. They become pathologic from chronic inflammatory states and diets that are more processed and don't contain as much of the biofilm disrupting herbs. The longer we have them, the more pathogenic they're going to become. Things that suppress our immune system can contribute to the pathogenicity of the biofilms. We can do things to help them get into a more healthy place, and we can do stuff to prevent them in the first place. But just because if we already have a misdirected immune response or an autoimmune condition that's starting to flare, and it does not necessarily mean we have fully pathogenic biofilms yet because of the fact that we have disruption and the misdirected immune response and the, just the activation of the immune response, even in non-pathogenic states, can cause a flare. So it doesn't necessarily mean it's pathogenic just because you're flaring, but if you're flaring, if you have pathogenic, it will cause a flare. Is that,
yeah, you
say that's a pretty accurate, very simple, but pretty.
I think a way, and I've seen this clinically, is especially in children, if the flare is really short and self-limited, it could be just a very mild, you know, mostly normal with a little added. If the flare is very remarkable, and you have to do some work to get things calmed down, it's somewhere in the pathogenic spectrum.
Yeah.
You know, and we need to keep in mind that, you know, children who already have all this going on, they're already pretty far down the trail, much further than their cohort would be. You know, they're more like a 40-year-old adult where the biofilm disruption comes in.
Yeah. And so since I have to bring things back to homeopathy at least a little bit, just because that's, you know, our area of expertise. Again, you know, I don't know if homeopathy can disrupt or can help busting biofilms and helping with everything. It can help reduce the susceptibility to the specific reaction that you're having to biofilms, for sure. And I believe that once you are doing the work, especially once they've been disrupted, that you can, that homeopathy can help your body repair it, so that help it get back to a more typical biofilm state. So this is one of the things we always bring people in to talk about, stuff where we might need additional support. And this is a place where we might need additional support in addition to homeopathy, and using homeopathy alongside any of these treatments to address biofilms can likely make it less less difficult. You know, it can ease the process, and it can help, again, you know, give our body information for what we're susceptible to, what symptoms we're susceptible to when we have exposure to these different things that the biofilm is holding. So they can really work in conjunction. And so that's why I'm really grateful that you're here to talk about this. And I guess the final thing that, you know, I need to make it again even more simple is, you should not really be doing this on your own if you're already in like a chronic inflammatory state. Yeah. And if you're dealing, whether it's PANS or if it's CIRS or MCAS or any of the things that have like chronic inflammatory states, that you really should be working with somebody who can help guide you through this, probably both a homeopath and somebody who's got expertise in biofilms and how to navigate the biofilm busters and mitigate all the stuff that can come up with it. So while you can do some of these on your own, you probably shouldn't, especially if you have a really big flare anytime that the biofilms are clearly being disrupted.
100%. It's not so much about what you might do to disrupt. It's how do you manage, you know, the immune disruption that, you know, can be very, very scary and things that need to be done. And to your point about whether it's homeopathics or other things, having a provider who understands how to shift during a flare. So whether that be, you know, an acute remedy to get you through the thing or a remedy and something else to get you through, that's what's required. Because what your brain will say is, oh, this is a really bad flare, we need to stop doing whatever triggered it. Well, you never get forward if you do that. Sometimes you have to, but you can't go forward. What you need to do is say, oh, this, we must have really got onto something here because the flare was magnificent. We're going to do things to mitigate all of those symptoms to the degree we can, make the child comfortable, feel, you know, more like they're back in their body, and then get them through. And what I've seen over and over is, and this is even in the, you know, older, say young teens, et cetera, where they have, I mean, their life is not great to start with, but when you do a disruption, they have phase two big biofilms, they disrupt in a very, you know, lots of symptoms. But once you get past that and you figure out, you know, whatever you need to do to balance the body's response without suppressing it, it's easier than each time. It's not like you go from a 10 to a 1, but, you know, they're already at an 8 of badness. They go to a 10, it's unfortunate. You can step them down, and then the next time it's less aggressive because your immune system's more involved and less freaked out each time.
And I'm glad you brought up suppression again, because we have to remember that, like, if we're trying to do this on our own, we're going to freak out. We're going to try to stop doing the thing. And we're probably going to use something that's maybe a baby suppression, but nevertheless a suppression. And as Dr. Anderson shared, that suppression can just contribute to worsening and progression of the pathogenicity of the biofilms themselves. So not like, you know, you can't go, you just give Rituxan to yourself or anything like that, but even using something like an anti-inflammatory is going to, like, temporarily interfere with a typical immune response, and I would assume can contribute.
Yes.
Yeah. All right. Any final thoughts that you would like to share with our community members? Things that we didn't talk about that we should have asked you about biofilms?
I could probably talk for days about it. So who knows what you didn't ask? Yeah. but I think, you know, I've been through this a lot with patients. I've had some. I mean, I've 5 children and 7 grandkids, a lot of kids around me. I've had it in my family, you know, with the grandkids, and been up close and personal, but also patients. And the thing that is, I totally understand, is the disruption it is as a parent to have this going on. And all you want is for your child, you know, to not feel the way they do.
Yeah.
And how difficult that is. And then, you know, in the case of not all, but some patients, you get things under really good control. Maybe they're really little and things are going great, but then they're growing up and maybe their diet shifts or maybe other things or dental things. And then all of a sudden it's like the body remembers a little too well how it used to respond, and you gotta, you know, kind of go back. So it's, I guess I'm mostly just saying, hang in there, parents. It's we've all been there, and it's a marathon. But not doing anything is not the way to make the marathon better. And so people like these folks are the people that can help.
Yeah.
Dr. And then last but not least, where can people find you if they want to learn more about you, or send their doctors to learn from you? Where can people find you?
So to make my life easier, I made a hub website. I didn't make it. Web people made a hub website. So if you're public, there's all sorts of links to stuff. And if you're a healthcare provider, there's a healthcare provider link. And it's just, it's called draanow.com, DRANOW, like Dr. A, DRANOW.com. And there's links there to whatever one might need.
All right, perfect. And we'll make sure we put a link to that in our show notes. Thank you so much for your generosity and coming and spending time with us today, Dr. Anderson. I hope that this helps people understand biofilms a little bit better, and gives them some opportunity to find ways that they can work through them and make sure that they're making the best possible choice for their kids and their family moving forward. So thank you very much for your time today.
Yeah,
we appreciate
you.
It.
I also wanted to share my appreciation, and on behalf of all of the PANS moms that will listen, we really appreciate you coming and spending some time talking to us, because I've been in the PANS world since 2016 and haven't had a opportunity to listen to anybody talk about this specific thing. And now I understand why Dr. Barr said all the lovely things that she did about you being an excellent teacher in the very beginning, because you were able to help me make sense of what biofilms are and kind of the role that they're playing in everything that's going on with our kiddos. So thank you so much. I appreciate your time very much.
Thank you for that. Thank you.
Okay. Take care, everybody.
Bye, guys.
Bye.
We hope you found this episode helpful, hopeful, and inspiring. We try to get a new episode out every week. You can make sure you don't miss any by following us on Spotify or subscribing to our channel on YouTube. If you want to connect with us more, join our Facebook group, Homeopathy for PANS and PANDAS, where we have exclusive weekly videos and answer your questions about, you guessed it, homeopathy for PANS and PANDAS throughout the week. If you are already a member, give us a shout out and let us know what you thought about this episode. If you aren't on Facebook and would like to reach us, you can email us at podcast@resiliencenaturopathic.com. Until next time, take care and remember, this won't be forever.